Welcome to Sabbath School class. I'm so glad that you decided to join us this morning. I'm sure that we're going to have a good time. We are in the book of Ecclesiastes, as most of you are aware. Chapter 2 is our main subject for today, but before we jump into that, let's have a word of prayer and we'll ask the deacons to take up the offering as we begin our Sabbath School class. Our kind, gracious, wonderful Father, we come before you now not because we believe that we're ever out of your presence, but because we ask a very special blessing, the guidance of your Holy Spirit as we open your word to understand it. As we look at the life and experiences of Solomon and those who lived around and with him, may we in some respects be wiser than he was. May we learn from his mistakes is our prayer in Jesus' name. Amen. Ecclesiastes 2 is not uplifting or encouraging reading. If you had to take Ecclesiastes 2 as your main picture of God, I suspect that you'd be in trouble. I would be. This is the story of a discouraged, depressed old king who had tried everything, and he's now telling us it was all worthless. And so we come to the challenge now of asking ourselves, why? Why did someone with all of that promise, I mean, remember the early years of his life, and he stands there in vision, I presume it was, God appeared to him and said, ask what you will. And he said, give me wisdom. And God says, that's wonderful. I'll give you not only that, but long life and, you know, riches and all the other things, power and glory and so forth. And he apparently got it. And yet, at the end of his life, he's saying, you know, this is all meaningless. It's useless. It's nothing but smoke, as some have translated. And Christians looking at this, and Bible scholars have looking at this, have said, well, this is what you should expect from a life that leaves God out. Which raises the next question, and that's where I really want to start our discussion this morning. Have you noticed that our scientific community, our news media, our government in one way or another, is doing everything possible to leave God out? If this is what happened to Solomon when he left God out, what's going to happen to us? I mean, our government was founded on Christian principles. The people who started this country, the people who emigrated here anyway, started this thing because they believed in Christian principles, and they didn't believe that they could live by those principles under the conditions where they came from. They weren't free to exercise their religious rights back where they came from. And so they came to this new country, this land where they believed that they would be free. And unfortunately, we know that while they wanted freedom for themselves, they weren't too happy at the beginning to give freedom to anybody else. But we ended up with this Bill of Rights, including, you know, the First Amendment and all that sort of stuff. And now we seem to have twisted that First Amendment right to try to, and the effect it's having is that we're going right back to where we started. In fact, before where we started, and we're following the example of Solomon. At least that's the way it seems to me. How do you feel about that? Am I stretching this way beyond what it's supposed to be stretched, or is it possible that that could be true? No. Okay, we got a hand back here. It's always good to break the ice.
I think it's spread to all walks of life. Generally speaking, we don't want to offend anybody, so it's basically the minority that complain that seem to be running the place. It's a mental paralysis that seems to have gripped us, and probably even wider into the Western world.
And we're saying we have to be politically correct, even if it's wrong. Brian.
Can it really be a pendulum if it only swings one way?
That's not a pendulum if it's always swinging one direction. No, it isn't.
And Solomon's experience was invaluable to the onlooking universe.
Mm-hmm.
What they learned from watching that and his words mm-hmm. were essentially very worthwhile.
Jim.
Historically, my observation is that the majority of control is done by the minority. The Revolutionary War was done by a minority, less than 3,000 people under arms at any one time. The Russian Revolution and the Communist Party was a minority, less than 10% or thereabouts. So just observe what the minority end up controlling. We have what now we call a dulocracy, where the slaves have so much power that they domineer.
Mm-hmm. The ones who are supposed to be serving us are ruling us, is what you're saying, huh? Go ahead.
Well, we understand that there's two forces that control this world, the force of good and the force of evil, God and Satan. So when we eliminate one force, then that leaves room for the other force to take over. So as we take God out of our life, that allows Satan to come into our life and control our life.
We're not left with a vacuum.
No.
Yeah, so true. Very true. Well, then I would ask this question next. You know, we humans are so prone to make mistakes. And we can watch someone else make a mistake, and we say, boy, that was foolish. And what happens next? We're doing the same thing. We have a really, really hard time learning from somebody else's mistakes. Now, if we learn, if we're actually able to learn through the study of the book of Ecclesiastes, to learn something from the mistakes of Solomon, does that make us wiser than he was? I'm just asking a question.
In that respect.
In that respect, huh? Well, it's something to think about. It's interesting when you go back and look at Proverbs. I mean, I suppose we should have read all of Ecclesiastes 2 before we started. But back in Proverbs, Solomon said some things that I thought we ought to review because they make a very interesting contrast with Ecclesiastes 2. Let's just read a few of these words. It starts with Proverbs 3, and you can see the verses outlined there on your mentioned there in number 5 in your handout. I'm going to read it here. This is the Good News Translation. Happy is anyone who becomes wise. Did Solomon become wise, and was he happy? Who gains understanding. There is more profit in it than there is in silver. It is worth more to you than gold. Wisdom is more valuable than jewels. Nothing you could want can compare with it. Wisdom offers you long life as well as wealth and honor. Wisdom can make your life pleasant and lead you safely through it. Those who become wise are happy. Wisdom will give them life. The Lord created the earth by his wisdom. By his knowledge, he set the sky in place. His wisdom caused the rivers to flow and the clouds to give rain to the earth. Hold on to your wisdom and insight, my son. Never let them get away from you. They will provide you with life, a pleasant and happy life. You can go safely on your way and never stumble. And he goes on expounding on the virtues of wisdom. So what happened? And this is part of one of the most important things we probably need to learn this quarter. How did Solomon get from that to where he is in the book of Ecclesiastes? What were those subtle influences, that subtle progress from being God's chosen to being, I mean, offering his children as sacrifices to a foreign, to a pagan, idolatrous God? I mean, how much lower can you go? Norm.
I think maybe the text that you just read is a clue to what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of depending on the God who provided him the wisdom, he began to depend on the wisdom itself
mm-hmm.
and to see what he was as wise. And when that happens, when our wisdom separates from control by God, we are in deep weeds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Brian?
I think Solomon is the best example of why God didn't want Israel to have a king. The whole purpose of a king is prolonging your reign, you know, being the one in charge. God, of course, is the one who created. To be a king is to forget you were created as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's a conflict of interest.
Okay. Well, coming back to Ecclesiastes 2 now, Solomon seems to suggest that his life was one continuous, relentless pursuit of happiness and pleasure. That's what it had been. Does this imply, and I want you to think now, back review in your mind his life as you understand it, does this imply that when he was working with God, when he was building the temple, he was building his own house, his palace, and so forth, and back in the early days when he seemed to be in harmony with God, that he wasn't happy then? Or did he, in all his wisdom, couldn't he perceive that he was becoming more and more unhappy as he moved away from God, or was he? What do you think? Okay. Second mic's coming. I know these are sort of huge questions, but...
Well, carnal pleasure is pleasurable, and it brings happiness for a short season, it says, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the pleasure that God brings that lasts forever. So as he's going through these times and accumulating all this wealth and fame and so forth, he's probably enjoying it. But it only lasts for a short time. And he's still seeking that thing that he's missing, which is the long-term joy and happiness. And that's when he gets to the end of his life. He's trying everything. He's trying to please his wives and do what they want and trying to find pleasure that way, and he's not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
And so all this stuff starts to pile up on him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's realizing that it's worthless to try to satisfy yourself with worldly things.
And this is something that we all have studied. We've read about it. We may be experiencing in our own life is that the thrills that the world provides are basically very short term. It seems like it may be exciting for a moment or two, but pretty quick it's gone and that's it. The earthly pleasures and thrills don't last very long. I mean, look at the amusement park business. Look at the entertainments in our world. I mean, what do you hear advertised on television? Newer, bigger, better, faster, more exciting, something you haven't seen before. I mean, what is implied by all of that? That implies that everything you've done before wasn't quite as good, right? That's what they're trying to get you to think. This is the best thing you've ever seen. This is the best thing you've ever done. Do it now. Taste it now. Try it now. You know? Better cars, better, everything's better, right? At least they want you to think so. But this ought to teach us something about human nature. Why is it that we have this drive for something bigger, better, faster, newer? Ryan.
If God hadn't given us that, Eve wouldn't have even been tempted by the fruit.
Okay. Yeah. So God, it was God's fault.
No, of course not.
No? I mean, have you ever thought about this? I mean, going back even to this experience with Eve, why did she want, was she malnourished in any way? Was she missing anything from all the fruit in the garden? Why did she need the fruit from that one tree?
Choices.
I hear people mumbling. Come on, let's out with
Eve
it.
Didn't experience food insecurity. But she did experience personal, you know, I mean, her own self-image insecurity. And security, and then, like Solomon, you know, she was puffed up first and then crashed.
Why do we have this almost insatiable desire to curiosity, to do something new, something different, something better? Where does that come from? You gonna help me here? Oh, here, go ahead, Wally.
Well, what did Lucifer lack?
Exactly. I mean, that's the place to go. Go back to Lucifer. What was he missing? Standing next to God in his throne in heaven? Boy, that sounds like a real spot of deprivation, doesn't it? John.
Well, I think Eve, after talking with the serpent for a while, began to feel insecure because she was created, and she was thinking about the one who created her, and she wanted to be like him.
You got to figure out something. There's always something about this new experience that sounds better, faster, newer, more exciting. I mean, why would we try it? Imagine the car advertisement says, well, we'll give you the same thing we've been doing for the last 5 years. It's about the same. Would anybody buy it? Yeah, Norm.
The idea of curiosity, of finding out how it works, to explore the new, is a God-given idea. Mm-hmm. But with that comes a responsibility. And we have to realize that everything that we look at, we have to evaluate it. Is it going to be good for us or not? Mm-hmm. And it's when we forget to use some common sense on our wants that we go crazy.
Okay. Well, in this chapter, Solomon seems to talk about two things. He's going to expound on these more as he goes on through the rest of the book. But in this chapter, he starts to talk about two things that I'd like to ask you about. He seems to be really upset by the fact that he can't be sure what his legacy is going to be. That's one. And the second, which is related to it, he doesn't have any control over what happens after he dies. Do you spend a lot of time worrying about those things? Wally.
You know, somehow or another, I have a feeling that God even sat down and talked privately with Lucifer about the situation. I don't believe that Lucifer didn't discuss this with God before he made this choice. Mm-hmm. I think privately he literally talked to God over the situation before he literally made the decision.
Yeah.
What he made. I think God, just like a father and son, sat down and discussed this.
Well,
before
Ellen White,
he made this decision.
You know, Ellen White says that God called all the angels and put them up there and had Christ standing beside him and says, look, this is the situation. These are the choices. Can't you understand what's going on here? This is what Lucifer is trying to say to you. Everybody. I mean, it wasn't just Lucifer that had that. God did that for everybody. You know, and you've heard me say this before, but I mean, just as an example on this thing, I mean, suppose that Eve had said to the serpent in the tree, okay, everything you say may be true. I don't have any basis on which to say whether it's true or not true. So I have a suggestion. I'll just wait for right now. I'll go discuss it with my husband. God will come along in the cool of the evening. We'll talk about it together. If it's a good idea, I'll be back tomorrow. The tree's been here every day. It'll still be here tomorrow. I mean, what is that driving force that we need to do it right now? Well, you know how the salesmen do. Well, we'll give you 10% more off if you sign on the line right now. What is that? Is that the devil's activity? And not to equate devils with salesmen, but you know. Well, think for a moment what Solomon's legacy was that he was so worried about. He wrote 3,000 proverbs. Oh, Dr. Baum, go ahead.
I don't know whether I get through this or not, but my personal feeling is that Satan, Lucifer, mm-hmm. has not really wrestled with the laws of choice. I think that Satan was a created being. I don't think Satan believes that God is really God. There's an plasma out there somewhere which put him in a position where he took on this role. But he really doesn't think that God is God.
He doesn't want to believe it.
Huh?
He doesn't want to believe it.
I can't say for that. Is that what you feel?
Well, he acts like he doesn't want to believe it.
Well, isn't that what sin's all about?
Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to know that somebody else is superior to us, that is in control over us, or has, you know, power over us or something like that. That may be part of it. I don't know. Solomon's legacy. Suppose you had written 3,000 proverbs and 1,000, more than 1,000 songs, and you wrote, even written 3 books in the Bible. Would you say, boy, I wish I could improve my legacy? I mean, what was the problem with Solomon thinking that he hadn't any legacy? Yeah.
I think that he...
Oh, just a minute. Microphone's coming. There you go.
I think it was a situation where the right place at the right time with the right people, and that this thing surfaced then and it's been with us ever since.
Yeah. Could be. Could be. Well, certainly Solomon had, the language here in Ecclesiastes 2 and 2, much of the rest of the book is not very joyous. One of the other things that Solomon does is something that we do all the time. And let me just ask you about that. Solomon starts to compare himself with others. Do we ever sort of secretly in our own minds ask ourselves if God grades on the curve? Now I look around, you see. Well, I mean, here's the sequence as I see it happening in our minds. We say, here I read the Bible and I see what God expects of me. So I'm thinking about all those things, and then I start looking at my life, and I get a little worried because my life doesn't seem to match up to what I read in Scripture. And I keep doing this, and I keep seeing that I'm not matching up, and I keep doing it. And after a while, I'm going, how's everybody else doing? You know, we tend to do this. And we see that other people are making mistakes, too. Okay, well... maybe I'm not so bad off because everybody else is doing it too. Does God grade on the curve? I'm just asking. Not quite sure. Hand down here.
I don't know if you can say that God grades on the curve, but God does grade us on our knowledge of truth. I mean, He's said in the Bible that, you know, if we are ignorant, then they're not accountable. Mm-hmm. So in a way, He bases His judgment of us based off of what we know about Him.
Okay. That sounds like a pretty absolute standard. It's not like any curve grading to me.
No, but He... what he
I mean, if we're being measured up alongside Jesus Christ... that leaves me feeling sort of about that high, right?
Yeah, well, we're not we can't compare ourselves to Christ, but that's our goal, is to become like Christ.
So that's
He's
the standard.
Our standard, yes.
Okay.
But what we don't know about Him, we're not accountable for.
So I better stop reading my Bible, stop reading all the good books, because every time I read them, I find something else I'm supposed to be doing.
I've heard that. I've heard people say that.
You've heard people say...
look at a pastor.
Yeah.
How many people put the pastor on a pedestal?
Yeah.
And say, I want to be like him. And then they find out how bad he is.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're starting to sound more and more like Solomon, I think. So what are we going to do with all this? If you had a chance to travel back in time, one of those fancy time machines that we see in the movies kind of thing, and you could go back to the days of Solomon and plant yourself in Jerusalem and just watch what's going on there and see what Solomon is doing and all of his activities and so forth, would you say his life was full, empty, somewhere in between? As you perceive it, as you picture it in your mind, what would you say about Solomon's life? I mean, we would be inclined to say Solomon had it all, right? I mean, that would be the sort of natural response. Well, let me suggest something to you. Number 12, you'll see there's a verse mentioned. John 10, verse 10. And here it is up on the screen. The thief comes only in order to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come in order that you might have life, life in all its fullness. Okay? Now, if we perceive in our mind that Solomon had a full life, and Jesus promises this kind of life, what's the difference between Solomon's full life and this full life that Jesus promises? As you know, I don't know if I'm asking questions that are too tough for us this morning. Myra.
I think Solomon was given a great gift of wisdom, and he wasted it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think God wants to give us that and have us use it.
So God would be willing to give us the same kind of wisdom, the same kind of benefits and advantages, but he's asking us to make good use of them?
Yeah.
Yeah? Well, we know the verse we looked at before, ask and you shall receive, knock and it'll be open to you, so forth. I mean, isn't that basically saying to us, if we accept that verse, what God said to Solomon? Wally.
You know, we keep saying Solomon wasted his wisdom, but yet we're sitting here using it.
Mm-hmm.
Did he waste it?
Well, that's a good question. Why did he feel so much like he had wasted? Now, the part of the problem is we're looking at one side of Solomon's life. We basically know about what he did in his early life when he was working with God, and then clear at the end of his life now as he's looking back on his wasted years. We don't have a book about what really happened in the middle of his life when he was as far away from God as he could get. I don't know whether that kind of a book would be very readable, but
Well, for me, I'm sitting here talking about it, and somehow or another, I don't feel that's being wasted. I mean, how many years ago did he live?
Yeah.
And yet I'm sitting right here talking about it. I don't feel that's being wasted at all.
And that's what we said a little while ago. 3,000 Proverbs, 1,000 songs, 3 books in the Bible, and here we are talking about it. I mean, I would say that's a pretty remarkable legacy. He didn't think it was a legacy. We got two hands back there.
It almost seems like Solomon is confusing wisdom with wealth, because there's nothing wrong with wisdom, and it was used well, profitably, but then he also was very wealthy, and that was not used properly, and he found no meaning in the wealth, but that doesn't mean that there's no meaning in the wisdom.
Okay. Go ahead, Van.
We're told that in the end, when we're in heaven and we see the panorama, that we will not choose to be led any different than what we are led. I'm wondering if he will feel the same way.
Well, the important point about that verse, which I think we sometimes sort of slide over, that quotation from Ellen White, is she says, we are not led other than we would choose to be led. That isn't talking about where we're going. It's talking about where we're led. If we're following God's leading, then we ought to be doing fine. It's when we're wandering by ourselves and not being led that there's a problem. Van's going to say something more there.
Well, who's to say that God was not working with him as he was allowing him to be led? I mean, it's clear that he arrived at the end point where he understood that all was folly that he was trying to do, and that the only thing that he could see at that point was really following God. Now, he didn't have the full message, and he didn't have the full blessings of doing that. He was trying to fill up his cup, and his cup was too big.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept filling and filling and filling and getting nowhere. And God promises us that our cup is going to run over. So he didn't understand that, at least at this point in the last of the book. Mm-hmm. But I think he will understand that, and he will look back and he will say, you know, I was pretty stubborn, and God led me every possibility that he could exert on me, he did, and I wouldn't choose to have it any different, because if I had my way about it, I'd be lost.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got a question there, an issue there. Solomon, after having all this, having all the things we've talked about, we say made a fool out of himself. We say that we can read his books, his book, particularly this one we're talking about now, but read all of his books for that matter, and we can learn something from them. And I asked you the question earlier, is it possible that if we can learn something from his mistakes, that we're wiser than Solomon? So now let's go back and review that for a moment. What were Solomon's big mistakes? Is pleasure, all of that includes, is pleasure always a no-no for Christians? Is God saying to us, well, you Christians, I want you to be happy, and the way for you to be happy is just to have less expectations? You shouldn't try to be too happy, because you know it's going to lead to problems. So just be satisfied with being moderately happy. Is that what God's saying to us? Yes.
Well, don't you think that maybe God uses these experiences to show us what life will be like in eternal heaven? That he has these things for us, that he could bring us happiness, and that he can provide us with all this in the eternal kingdom. But knowing that in the world with sin, that we're swayed by evil forces, and that's what demonstrated here with Solomon, that God gave him all this stuff to make him happy, to show him what godly wisdom will give him and what godly gifts will give him if he accepts them as a gift from God rather than a gift from the world. And the lesson that we're taught here is that we have to learn from Solomon's mistakes to show the greatness of what God can do for us if we follow him and we...
Okay. Now, let me just ask this question. I got a couple of other hands. Don't forget what you want to say. We got one here. You got a mic there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll be with you in just a second. It was there any pleasure that you can think of? Any kind of worldly pleasure, like the stuff that's advertised on TV and so forth? Were there any of those things that Solomon didn't have? Did he try every pleasure that he could think of? Think about that for a moment. Brian, go ahead.
Yeah, it may be a look at the difference between joy and happiness. You know, if you are thankful, if God is involved, you can be very unhappy and still be filled with joy. You know, and pleasure, you know, if you're grateful or gratitude is given to God, you know, it's a blessing rather than a curse.
Okay, you're making a difference between joy and happiness. That's interesting. Okay.
Well, we find that the happiness in the world, the things that they think will make them happy, going out dancing and drinking and, you know, that doesn't make me happy. My happiness is in the Lord and in my family and the things and working with people and the little pleasures of helping or this and that. So I think that the Christian life is extremely happy, and these worldly people and their pleasures aren't. And Solomon, at the very beginning, didn't follow God's law because, you know, he wasn't supposed to bring horses from Egypt. He wasn't supposed to have more than one wife. It was all in Deuteronomy. He did all those things. So there, it kind of was a, uh-oh, something's going to go wrong here.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's look at some examples. You pointed to the next section of our lesson. Look at number 15 in your handout. In ancient Greek Platonic thinking, which was widely accepted in the days of Jesus, it was believed that anything that was pleasant and pleasurable and thus of benefit to the body, now you remember, you've heard this talk about Greek dualism, anything that would be of benefit to the body was automatically dangerous or detrimental to the soul. Thus, if you wanted to benefit your soul, you must persecute, torment, or at least deny the body. Is there any truth in that idea? You know, you see these ancient pictures of Jesus hanging on the cross, and he's skin and bones. And all the apostles are skin and bones. And why was that? Because obviously if they were saints, they had to be denying their body all the time. Because there's this battle going on between body and soul, and if you're doing something to benefit the body, then by definition you're not helping out your soul. And if you're doing something for the benefit of your soul, like these saints must have been all the time, then obviously you're doing something that's not good for your body. I mean, is that complete nonsense, or is there any truth in that?
That's basic Catholic theology, because that came from Augustine. Okay. And Augustine had a real problem with women. So he took this Greek dual stuff and felt that you shouldn't have sex, for example, unless it was to have children. Any other activity was bad.
He would have eliminated that if he could, but he couldn't figure out any way to have kids without that.
So that's why the Catholic Church, even today, accepts only one type of birth control, which means more Catholic votes.
Yeah, you noticed that too. Especially south of the border, yeah. Okay, well, following that along, look at number 16. Think of all the friends that you've had during your life. Among them, there must have been some who were selfish pleasure seekers. Undoubtedly, there were also some who denied self for the purpose of loving and serving others. Which of these two groups or individuals do you think were happier? How did you think about that for a moment? Anybody want to respond to that? Yeah.
I observe that when people have sort of left God out of their life, and they're trying to, particularly older people like us, they can just go all over the world.
You couldn't be talking about yourself.
Wild. And the thing is, they just... they start doing it more and more and more, and you can tell it's not really satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Someone ought to do a survey sometime. Maybe someone has. You ought to stand outside of Magic Mountain and, or maybe Disneyland or Knott's Berry Farm at the end of the day and survey the people coming out and see if they're really, really happy. You know, the happiest place on earth. You know, if you really could ask them, is that really happiness? Yes.
I think we got to be a little careful here. I've known some pleasure seekers that, at least from outward appearance, who were not religious, seemed happy. I've also known a situation. I grew up in a small Adventist country church, and there were two or three people there, so-called saints, who were anything but happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Did that mean that they're the standard for the rest of us? I hope not. I think, have all probably known a few like that. I don't think that's the standard we need to set up for anybody. Go ahead.
Well, I've had some personal experience with that. I used to work in the corporate world, and with all these people that were considered wealthy and had everything, their boats, their vacation homes, and everything, the money that they needed, and they weren't happy. They, mm-hmm. You know, my struggle to climb the corporate ladder was stopped when I saw what it brought you. But then I met people who had nothing, that helped others, that gave everything away, and they were much happier in their life.
Was Jesus happy?
Yes.
I mean, how much did he have? How much of his time did he spend working for other people? He gave till he was ready to drop. I mean, at the end of every day, he would collapse, and probably not onto a Simmons beauty rest either. I mean, this guy is sleeping beside the road. Was he happy? Well, absolutely he was happy, because he was doing what he knew that his Father and he himself wanted to do. So the standards we usually think of are maybe not the real true standards. Look at number 18 in your handout. Addiction has become a major study theme in the field of health. Yeah, Norm.
Doing what your Father wants you to do makes you happy. Do you think Jesus was full of happiness as he hung on the cross?
Well,
I think he was happy when he said, it is finished. I did it. Now, it wasn't comfortable. I didn't say comfortable. I think he was satisfied. He was happy that he had accomplished what he came to do. I would think after what he'd been through, especially in the last, 18 hours or something, 24 hours, you'd be happy to say it's over. Wally.
I think that's the key in anything, is when you're doing something that you really enjoy, even though it may be uncomfortable at times, it makes you happy. Mm-hmm. After you've finished a job that may be a little, take a little bit out of you, it's enjoyable once you finish it.
Look at number 20 in your handout. There's an interesting little story that Dr. Neese used to tell. See what you think of this. Dr. Richard Neese attended the UCLA School of Psychology, got degrees in clinical and experimental psychology. Starting at the time he entered the program, he realized that sooner or later, someone was going to challenge him about his Christian beliefs. When one of his classmates discovered that he was a Christian, that classmate began to harass him about his foolish ideas. On one occasion, the classmate directly confronted him and challenged him with his foolish pie-in-the-sky ideas. So Dr. Neese responded with this challenge of his own. Let us suppose there's a 50% chance that you are right, that there is nothing at all beyond this life. And let us also suppose there's a 50% chance that I am right and that there is an eternity in heaven. Sooner or later, we will both die. If I am right and have lived a life according to God's plan, I will experience an eternity of bliss and you will receive nothing. If you are right, we will both die and be dead a long time. Immediately his classmate responded, but what about all the pleasures in this world right now that you are missing? Dr. Neese's response was, I am very happy with my life as it is, and I would not change the way I live even if there were no pie in the sky. The amazed classmate had nothing more to say. And the question for us, could you confidently make the same claim that Dr. Neese did? What about that? Not asking anybody particularly to respond or to tell us about your personal life, but it's certainly one something very interesting to think about. Yes, Vernon.
I'd like to ask the question. We're dealing with happiness and joy. Are they both the same? Can you have joy and not have the giggling experience of a carnival action?
What about that? Yes.
I think we need to put a couple extra words into the conversation here, in place or to regarding happiness and joy. Peace and contentment seem to me that they would epitomize happiness and joy, where stimulation and excitement epitomize more of the world's outlook on the need to keep going, keep stimulating, keep finding the newest, exciting, latest thing. Mm-hmm. And the Christian does appreciate a certain amount, a modest amount of stimulation and excitement, but we can have peace and joy and we don't live for the stimulation and the excitement.
Okay. Very good. Jim.
We're talking about joy and happiness, and we're talking about Jesus being happy at the when he says that it's finished. Remember, just there, John 17, one of my favorite chapters, he says, I've accomplished the work you gave me to do. He said that before he died. Mm-hmm. And then, still part of this prayer, I think it's verse 15, but now I am coming to thee, and these things I speak to the world that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. Mm-hmm. Jesus is praying this to the Father.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you a question. Hypothetical questions are always a little scary and, they can go almost anywhere, but a hypothetical question. In Solomon's early life, he built that magnificent temple.
which unfortunately ended up being called not God's temple, but Solomon's temple. We usually say Solomon's temple, don't we? So it ended up being built to the glory of Solomon. He also built himself an elaborate palace, which took longer to build and was much larger than the temple itself. By today's standards, I'm sure there were millions, maybe billions of dollars spent on those two buildings. I mean, you talk about covering a building with gold. You know, what does that cost? You know, think about it. And everything that was in there, precious stones and so forth, what does all that cost? What would have happened? What would have happened if Solomon said, we don't need a couple of expensive buildings here in Jerusalem. Let's do something different that might make a real difference. Suppose he had taken that money and said, let's set up an educational system. Let's set up a system of synagogues. Now, you know the difference between a sanctuary or a temple and a synagogue. Synagogues where people come together to be instructed in the truth about God, to be instructed in scriptures and so forth. Suppose he had said, okay, let's build synagogues for every village in our country. Let's build schools for every village. And let's take this wisdom that God has given me and let's make it available to as far as possible to everybody in the country. What would have happened? I know this is a way out idea, but okay, go ahead. Oh, hold on, microphone's coming.
I think if that had happened, that Israel would have probably not have apostatized so much. They were always backsliding and worshiping other gods, and if they had a synagogue in every village and proper instruction and teachers, it may have saved a lot of pain for Israel compared to, say, just having that big fancy palace.
I can't help but think that Israel would have just leapfrogged in the world, and the whole world would have crowded in to say, wow, what are you doing here? Where did you learn all that stuff? You know, Israel would have been full of universities, I mean, you know, using modern terminology, and the whole world would have said, let's come here. We want to know. Where did you learn all this? And Solomon would have become famous as the chief professor, whatever he would be called, you know. What a difference of legacy if he had done that instead of, you know, he dies and what's left? A couple of brick and gold buildings, you know, or stone and gold buildings. What a difference it might have made. And of course, we have to ask ourselves honestly, where did all that wealth come from? Did it just drop out of the sky? God promised him that it would come. But like you said, it came from, and there's some statements about this down here. 22, how did Solomon amass all that wealth? Was it God's plan for one person to enjoy all that luxury at the expense of so many others? Ellen G. White states specifically that his lavish palace was built and supported by an extreme form of taxation. Prophets and Kings, page 56. Thousands and thousands of non-Hebrew slaves and many Hebrews working at less than fair wages were required to meet Solomon's demands. What is there any way that you could call that kind of a system a blessing from God? I mean, couldn't Solomon in all his wisdom have seen that? Shouldn't he have seen that? And of course, you know what this questions this raises. What about us today? Number 23 there. Jesus tells us that the poor will always be with us. You know that verse, Matthew 26:11. That implies that there will be others who are better off or even rich. Does this mean that there is no way to solve the class struggle between the rich and poor? Should we stop even trying? And then, do Seventh-day Adventists as a church or as individuals have any responsibility for trying to correct the abuses in our society, especially between rich and poor? What about that?
Well, isn't the United States an example of, in a way, of that today? When the United States was first settled and churches were everywhere and God was in everybody's lives and the nation flourished and developed, in the old days, Jerusalem was called the glorious land. Today, the United States is called the glorious land. Mm-hmm. Aren't we an example of what would happen if that was done? But what are we doing with it now?
Yeah. Where are we in Solomon's life? You know, my hand is going. I mean, where are we in Solomon's life? Aren't we repeating the problems, the story of his life? And maybe that's why we're studying the book of Ecclesiastes. The question then becomes really this one. Considering everything that Solomon had and everything, I mean, if you went out on the streets of San Bernardino or Los Angeles or New York and took a survey, okay, what do you need, what would you like to have to make you happy? And you made a list, a composite list, don't you think Solomon would have had virtually everything that would be on that list? Probably so. I mean, someone might come up with something. I mean, obviously, the modern conveniences, he wouldn't have a car, but he had a chariot, probably a very fancy one. I mean, Song of Solomon talks about the chariot that's woven with love from the girls in Jerusalem. Remember that? It must have been quite an affair. You know, people to carry him around if he wanted them to, etc. But I think Solomon probably had everything that was on that list except... Some people have said that there's a God-shaped hole in everybody's life. And only God can fill that hole and make us complete. Was that Solomon's problem? What do we, I mean, that has the sort of warm, fuzzy kind of implications for us, but what does that really mean? What do you think it means? Yeah, Vernon.
Hasn't God given us the power of choice, and we can choose to have pleasure, satisfaction, and joy by the things that are according to God's will and righteousness, or we can be titillated with all of the foolishness that goes on in life. I knew a man who became a millionaire, multimillionaire. And before he came that, he was so poor that the mortgage on his hotel, he went to the man who held the mortgage. He said, take the motel. I cannot handle it anymore. And the man said, no, you just pay interest as you can. The day will change. The day changed for him. His hotel was filled every night. And he invested that money. He made his money off of investment. And he told me one day, he said, I have no pleasure in spending my money. I have pleasure in making it. And he lived that kind of a life.
Yeah. Well, you know, we all know stories. What was this about 5 years ago now? Some lady donated some phenomenal $62 million, $72 million to one of the big universities back on the East Coast. And no one had ever heard of her. And I found out she was living in a cold little, like, one-room apartment, ate cold oatmeal for breakfast because she didn't want to waste the money to heat up her oatmeal. And she had this millions and millions and millions of dollars. I mean, let's be thankful she donated it to a good cause. But, I mean, is that necessary? You can't even heat your oatmeal in the morning? Norm.
A God-shaped hole, what does that mean? I think it means that we were designed by a loving creator in an orderly system. And in that design was a place where we are to have a relationship with him. Without that relationship, we can't function. And that's a nice fuzzy way of saying we have to have that connection with God.
Yeah. There's no hand back here. We got to keep it a little short. The time is racing.
I think Solomon answers that question in chapter 3 with the one sentence that says, God has set eternity in our hearts.
Yeah, that's for next week. Yeah, fair enough. Well, one of the things that Solomon talks a lot about here in the whole book of Ecclesiastes, and I just want to mention this before we finish, is foolishness, folly. And someone has suggested that folly... It would perhaps best be described as the attempt to live on the edge.
For Christians, that might mean to live as close to sin as you can without actually sinning. And there's an ancient story that's told. Ellen White talks about it, but I couldn't find her exact quotation. It's under number 30 in your handout. As a conclusion, look at this, see what you think. There's a story of an ancient king who lived on a high, steep mountain. On one time, he was looking for a driver for his carriage. Three applicants were interviewed, and each was asked only one question. They were taken to a very narrow part of the road where there was a long drop-off right beside the road. The king asked each of them, how close can you drive to the edge and still be safe? The first driver looked carefully at the situation and said, I can drive within 1 foot. He turned to the second driver who said he could drive within 6 inches. He then turned to the third driver and asked the same question. The third driver, after carefully looking things over, said, the only safe place on that road is as far from the edge as possible. Who do you think got the job? So, in this lesson on Ecclesiastes, and particularly here in Lesson 2, we've seen that Solomon has great, great concern about a couple of, I would consider, foolish things. One, I don't have any control over what happens after I die, and I don't have a huge lot of control over the legacy that I leave. People are going to look at my life, look at Solomon's life, and evaluate that based on the future implications of everything he said and did. And that's partly determined, well, it's considerable, to a considerable extent determined by things that we have no control over whatsoever. Does that mean that our lives are foolishness, nothing but smoke, useless? I don't think so. I think that we have the opportunity to live lives that have a great deal of meaning. And of course, the secret, I believe, is to live those lives in cooperation, in companionship, in fellowship with God, who will guide us, as Van said earlier, always leading us in the right way, so long as we're willing to follow. Let's close with a word of prayer. Our kind and loving Father, we have so many things to be thankful for. Even this sordid story of Solomon and his fall into disgrace. Now he's coming back and telling us how worthless it all was. May we be able to learn something that will be a benefit to us in our day. We thank you for this opportunity to meet in a quiet and comfortable place to talk about you especially, and also about some of those who have striven in the past to live a life according to your will, and those who have failed miserably. We ask that you'll be with us through this coming week. Until we meet again, is our prayer in Jesus' sake. Amen. I need to take a second or two and make an announcement. Once a year, in fact, Brother Haddad, why don't you just come up and tell us, make your announcement, and then I'll talk to the class about what that implies for us. Yeah, why don't you give him one of those? It'll be easier if you give him one of those mics.
Good morning. I'm Edmund Haddad.